Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the epidemic of childhood illnesses due to our agrochemical food industry and the complete failure of federal policies and agencies, from the USDA to the FDA to the CDC, U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, they have all failed. Not only have they failed, but we're going to pull far enough back to see how this happened and how major corporations consider profit their number one priority, that's their fiduciary responsibility, increase the value of the stock in their company to make sure they give dividends. Almost 40 years ago, in fact, it was 41 years ago in 1977, I found that there was a woman in Boston who was so concerned about the health of children and their diets that she started a small organization, and she was critical of advertisements and what those advertisements meant. So I began to monitor, after listening to her, I began to monitor television commercials. In fact, for one weekend, Saturday and Sunday, I simply watched the commercials. 95% of the commercials for children were of something that would cause disease. I then spoke with a Dr. Feingold in California. He had just completed a report showing that children were susceptible to dyes and chemicals and foods and preservatives and additives. These were the hidden allergens that could impact the child's immune system. I then called someone I knew who was the father in America of environmental medicine, Dr. Randolph. Theron Randolph in Chicago. There was also a pediatrician there, and I spoke with him as well and asked him about, do you believe that the vaccine schedule is currently, and that was 1977, is impacting children's immune system to the degree of having autoimmune reactions? He said yes. Dr. Feingold said it's the food. There was a doctor in Connecticut, Norwalk, Connecticut, who said, we're seeing an epidemic of childhood allergens such as dairy that cause bedwetting and puffiness into the eyes and inflammation of mucus glands, excessive mucus in the nose and the throat, but we're also seeing it in adults, and we're not recognizing it. And he gave me a specific example of how a former Nassau physician came to him because he was having such crippling arthritis he was going to have to retire from medicine. And his joints were swollen, inflamed. He had severe arthritis. And at that time, the American Rheumatology Society said there is no connection between diet and arthritis, either in the cause or the treatment. In fact, I debated the head of that association on my radio program at the time. So anyhow, in comes the doctor to Dr. Marshall Mandel in Norwalk, Connecticut. And Mandel had diluted solutions, almost homeopathic in nature. And he would have the man sit in a chair with a clock behind him, one of those large clocks, and he would then have the man put one drop, just one single drop under his tongue, stand up, walk to the end of the hallway, and back. Now, no one knew what was in the jars. It was double-blinded. There was a number on the bottom of the jar, but no one was allowed to look at that. Now, I watched the film, and here the man is doing fine. For about 9 of these bottles, nothing happens. But then on the 10th bottle, he puts a single drop under the tongue, and he can't stand up. He's wobbling, he's losing his balance, and it took him almost 12 minutes for neutralizing dose to getting back to normal. So they turned the bottle over, they wrote it down, the number, they then mixed the bottles up again in another room and did it again. Same identical thing happened. Only to that one bottle, his whole immune system would become highly inflamed, agitated, and he would be impacted at the nervous system level. This is a big message for those of you out there who wonder how Kenny, a a plumber who's appeared on this program, had end-stage multiple sclerosis and today is completely normal and healthy, with two separate sets of neurologists saying, we don't know what happened, how it happened, but it did. He is not alone. There are others that have done this as well. So severe allergens can impact your motor sensory system, your thyroid gland, all over your body. And it turns out the man was allergic to beef. So he went on a beef-free diet, his arthritis cleared up, his inflammation, his joints, all changed, he went back to work. About 2 months later, he got a call, Dr. Mandel got a call, said, it's back. Mandel said, I absolutely have had no meat at all. But it turns out he had attended a dinner where he had gelatin, and gelatin is from beef and pork, and it flared up again. I give you those as examples simply to say that it's been 40 years with some outstanding scientists showing that we can be impacted based upon what we drink and eat, and we're still not paying the attention that it deserves. Hence, I've invited two individuals. One is Dr. Michelle Perro, P-E-R-R-O. She's a 35-year practicing board-certified pediatrician. She practices acute and integrative medicine. And for the past 10 years, her clinical practice has dealt more with pesticides and food health advocacy. She recently became a major voice in warning the public about GMO foods and food toxins and pesticides and their health risks. She has been both a director and physician at New York's Metropolitan Hospital and the University of California San Francisco Children's Hospital in Oakland. And she ran Down to Earth Pediatrics, which is a holistic urgent care clinic for children, more recently, is an integrative physician at the Institute for Health and Healing at Sutter Place Medical Center in Sacramento. And she is the author, co-author, I should say, of a book that is co-written with my next guest, and that next guest is on the line also, Professor Vincanne, that's V-I-N-C-A-N-N-E, Adams, a professor and vice chair of medical anthropology in the Department of Anthropology, History, and Social Medicine at the University of California Medical School in San Francisco. And her areas of specialty have been the history and development of medical anthropology, reproductive health, and scientific medical sociology and health policies. And she is also the editor for the Medical Anthropology Quarterly. And she has taught at Princeton University for a number of years, and she graduated with a doctorate in medical anthropology from the University of California at Berkeley, San Francisco. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you. glad to be here, Gary. Thanks so much.
Glad to be here as well. This has been fun.
Earlier when you were on the program last Thursday, we were reviewing some of the studies that have indicated the serious health risks of consuming GMO foods. One was the work of British scientist Dr. Putzai, who noted GMO's association with leaky gut syndrome, and the other doctor, who was finding GMO's contributing to oxidative stress and tumor development and histamine release that could be associated with allergies and asthma. Now, I don't want to repeat much of that conversation. Therefore, I encourage the listeners to listen to that last Thursday's broadcast on the noon show. You can get it in our archives. But I'd like you to begin by speaking on some of the other scientific research that you feel is most convincing to give GMO foods an agricultural black box warning. And you mentioned Dr. Cerellini's work in France, which the agricultural industry has attempted to remove from the scientific record. He sued them for slander, and he won. The media did not cover that. And one final add-on here. Virtually every single scientist and physician, journalist and activist who speaks against GMOs is on target list. They're harassed. They're put on quack lists. Their Wikipedia pages shows them as being non-credible. There are trolls working against them constantly. And this is a concerted effort. This is not just a few angry people who would disagree. This is a whole industry campaign to stop the public and the media from telling the truth about GMOs. The forum is yours.
Thank you so much, Gary. This is Michelle Perro speaking. We'll identify ourselves in the beginning until your listeners can identify who's saying what. But I can just point out that there have been a lot of researchers, in addition to what we spoke about your last show, some have focused just on the genetic modification process. Some have focused just on pesticides, and some have focused on both. And as you already mentioned, Dr. Pusey and Dr. Michael Antonio, we talked about their research. But in addition, your listeners can look into the research of Dr. Judy Carman from Australia, Dr. Jack Heinemann from Australia, Dr. Monica Kruger from Germany did some tremendous research, Drs. Andres Carrasco, Ignacio Chapella, a work of Chuck Benbrook, Ray Seidler, Dave Schubert. There are many scientists who have contributed to the field, and let me not forget, of course, Dr. Brenda Eskenazi from UC Berkeley. So your list, there is a plethora of authors, in addition to Seralini, who you mentioned, who've written about this field. And what you've also pointed to, Gary, so eloquently said, for those of us, and particularly the scientists who have spoken out in the past, hopefully not us in that equation, Dr. Adams and myself, that they have been under siege, under attack. They've been personally discredited. They had their careers tossed about, and some of them absolutely destroyed because of a daring to question the validity of the science that had been proposed. So just to give your listeners a flavor of what's out there.
All right. Please, Dr. Adams, add on to that and begin the process of explaining why GMOs are dangerous and what your research has shown they could do, especially to the still developing immune systems and biochemistry of a young person.
Sure. I mean, there are many ways, directions we could go in with this topic. It's important to know that there are some researchers who are doing great work. There are increasing numbers of researchers doing work on this, and so far they have not been attacked. Not everyone has. There is a surprising amount of evidence that there is some effort to silence people who have published in the past on the dangers of GM foods, and that in some strange way lends credibility to the argument that there isn't actually consensus on this topic. But GM foods are a strange topic because unlike with the tobacco issue and the climate issue, genetic modification of food science has oddly convinced most scientists that they're safe, but most of the public believes they're not. And so this topic cross-cuts those other kinds of debates about why we should not trust the science entirely on this. And that's a really interesting fact. Going back to the question of what evidence is there that these foods are dangerous to health, a couple of things that we really touch on and elaborate on in the book are not just the science that's available that shows there are impacts to the body, but the new fields of biomedicine that are showing that we need to think about health in a different way, and we need to think about diagnoses in a different way. So two topics that we cover fairly thoroughly are the question of the microbiome and the role of the microbiome in keeping people healthy, and the possibility, the strong possibility, that a lot of the pesticides and the genetically modified technologies themselves may be impacting the microbes of our gut, which are needed for nutritional processes in the body. And then another syndrome that we look at in detail is something called leaky gut. And there's a lot of controversy about this topic as well. We tried to stick pretty close to the science coming out of researchers at Harvard who are looking at the ways in which the normal permeability of the gut can be impacted by food problems, allergies, other things, and that when the leaky gut, when the gut becomes too permeable, things pass into the bloodstream and create an immune response. And that's one of the pathways that we are saying we now know more about, which lends more credibility to the relationship between foods that have contamination or foods that are made into pesticides or that come loaded with pesticides and this chronic array of health disorders.
All right. for those in the audience who are not familiar with GMOs, how widely used they are, how many different products are consumed, take us through at this time, please, a list of the foods and the evolution of genetic engineering and why we should be concerned about this. Michelle, give us a history now so that those who have not heard you or this program before will be more up to date.
Certainly. So to answer your question about the list of genetically modified foods now, that the majority of corn, soy, canola, and cotton crops now in the U.S., over 90% for mostly all those, 94% for corn and soy, are genetically modified. Also, sugar from sugar beets is genetically modified food. Alfalfa that is fed to livestock is GM. There are other crops like zucchini. 50% of papayas from Hawaii are genetically modified. You also have new foods that are genetically modified, such as the Arctic apple and the innate potato, recent additions to the list. Additionally, there are different microbes that are genetically modified that produce, for example, beer. Yeast is genetically modified. And also different medications that are used in insulin come from a genetically modified E. coli. So the list is pretty pervasive on what is genetically modified. There are new crops being introduced all the time. They're looking at genetically modification. In addition, they're also looking at additions to create a healthier GM food, such as golden rice, where they're trying to bring vitamin A into the rice, which has been a failed experiment for at least the past 20 years that they've been trying to do this. So those are, if you eat in a supermarket processed foods, you will be eating genetically modified food. 85% of processed foods contain a genetic modification product, such as soy lecithin, which appears just about in everything, is also genetically modified. There's also milk that has bovine growth hormone that is genetically modified. So you can see trying to feed a child, for example, a non-GM product, you almost need your PhD to figure this out, Gary.
Let's go a little further. Then, Ken, would you take us through what the prevailing scientific literature shows about GM products? And also, under Freedom of Information Act request, a state or a federal official found almost 13,000 records or pages of information from Monsanto that the public was not aware of, no one had seen before, that showed that they saw problems with this from the very beginning, and much like the tobacco industry, hid this from the public. Yet even after that came out, and a Professor Senefe of MIT has reviewed that, there's been no outcry. It's as if the media didn't care that this major information dump was put upon the table with all this really horrific results of GMOs. They shrugged their shoulders.
Well, okay, so the way I like to look at this is, you know, these crops were, and these technologies were developed in the post-DDT era, when it became very clear that DDT was really a carcinogenic, and there was a concerted effort to try to get rid of the worst of the chemical toxicants that were being used. They were actually, you know, a lot of these technologies were developed for warfare as anti-exfoliants and insecticides, and they were brought home, and then they were used on our crops at home. And, you know, with the outcry about use of things like DDT, the chemical companies really tried hard to come up with technologies that would be safer for humans. Now, it was originally thought that the use of the two main genetic modifications that are used are the Roundup Ready crops, which allow a plant to be sprayed with Roundup and not die. And then the other is the use of BT or Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a naturally occurring toxicant to insects. And the genetic modification put the protein from BT into the plant so that the plant was essentially turned into a pesticide. Both of these were considered safe for humans when they originally designed them, at least according to their main researchers from the documents that I've read. And the reasons were that they thought that the glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, would not impact human cells because it didn't have the molecular pathway that the plants had. But we now know that with the microbiome, these cells are being impacted because the microbes in our gut are like plants. They are impacted by this chemical. The BT, it was thought, wouldn't be impactful to humans because the pH of the human gut was higher than in plants, and it wouldn't activate the protein. But we now know that that protein that kills insects is actually pre-activated in most of the plants. And so there was a lot of misunderstanding. The assumption was that you could actually design these plants so that they would use less pesticide. And initially, that was probably true for the use of BT. But we now know that with the incredible resistance that's been evolving among weeds and among insects to both of these technologies, we've had to increase the toxicity of chemicals that are used, increasing the amount that we've had to use, and we're just loading our food supply, our non-organic food supply, with pesticides, both herbicides and insecticides. So we are using more than we used to, and we now know that these are probably harmful. Now, if you're talking about the fact that the companies may have hid or deliberately obfuscated the truth about these, there are two very good resources that you can get on this. You won't find a lot of it in our book. You will find a lot about the attacks on scientists. But the two books that are available on that are one called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth by Stephen Drucker. Another one is called Whitewash by Carrie Gillam. So those are great resources on that. It is an interesting problem, and this is why we say in the book that the template for this is really that history will show that what's happening with the science is very similar to what happened in the tobacco story, where the scientists knew it was harmful. The company paid a lot of industry scientists were hired to write things. A lot of non-industry scientists were paid as guest authors or ghostwriters in order to publish articles that obscured the risks on these things. So I think that in the end, that's what's going to come out. That's what's starting to come out already on these. It's a tragic story in many ways.
Gary, do you mind if I add on one thing there?
Please.
As a clinician, the concern that I have as a clinician, because here we are trying to, wade through this massive amounts of data and emails and, who has time for this when you're busy seeing patients all day, correct? But so you know that glyphosate was declared a Class 2A carcinogen by IARC in May of 2015. And here we are eating this stuff for at least the past 30 years. We've been chowing on glyphosate in our human diets, and now it's ubiquitous. However, to your point that you mentioned prior, that in 1983, when Monsanto was first presenting this data regarding glyphosate, scientists at the EPA did find evidence of cancer in kidney cells in rats who are fed glyphosate. So there was evidence of carcinogenicity that was early. And so the agribusiness who was studying this, it was Monsanto, went back and had these slides re-reviewed by other pathologists who then had other findings. So what I find somewhat unconscionable that if indeed that this was information known, and here we are, 30 years later dealing with the carcinogenic potential of this simple molecule glyphosate, that to me is hard to reckon with, Gary, as a clinician.
We'll continue with that thought, because with respect to pediatric health, and because we're witnessing many epidemics in childhood illnesses, please summarize some of these epidemics that may be associated with conventional and GMO foods that now dominate the average American diet. And with respect to autism, if you would share what you know that could be impacting susceptible children to go somewhere on that autism spectrum disorder from their genetic susceptibility, environmental toxins, including but not limited to vaccines and GMOs?
Certainly. So the as we said in the subtitle, of our book about the epidemic of chronic illness, indeed that is true. One out of two American children now has a chronic disease. The palette and array of, decline in health stems from across every body system. So So if you look at beginning with the gut, because integrative medicine does begin with the gut, the rate of food allergies now affecting children is 40% of kids. And there are chronic gut complaints of children, such as chronic constipation, reflux, bloating, and certainly not life-threatening, but not comfortable for children. And certainly there are sequelae to these simple issues that parents deal with every day. Asthma now affects 1 in 8 children, 1 in 6 African-American children, and the stats are probably similar for Latino children. And asthma now is not a benign disease, although it's such a common disease, and is now starting to be thought of even as an autoimmune disease. We have an epidemic, which is well known, of obesity, anywhere from 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 children, depending on what part of the country you live in, and with the subsequent problems from obesity that come later, such as metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and such. Endocrinopathies, there's a rise in thyroid disorders, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and diabetes, as I mentioned. And what concerned me most as a clinician and a pediatrician is the rise in autism, to your last point, where autistic spectrum disorder was 1 in 10,000 when I was a resident in Bellevue Hospital decades ago. It's now affecting 1 in 68 children, 1 in 43 boys. It's more common in boys than girls. And I've heard anecdotal evidence of late that it's now affecting 1 in 34 boys. And so the numbers had kind of leveled off for a while, and now it's increasing again. So to look, and the list goes on, Gary, that is an incomplete list. And we could even go into further, but I think you get the picture and your listeners get the picture.
I appreciate that insight.
Oh, of course. So autism spectrum disorder, and I won't give an expose on that problem because it's a complex condition. However, these are some of the sickest children I've ever cared for in my own practice. They have profound disorders relating to the gut. And there seem to be some common factors. And what's common that can be related to our industrial food are food allergies, which can be pretty severe. And we link that in the book to how GMOs and their associated pesticides do cause these issues of the gut. So children on the spectrum indeed have a severe rate of food allergies, most profound. They have significant nutrient deficiencies such as magnesium and zinc, and those are required. For example, zinc is required for over 200 reactions in your brain, that particular metal. And they have abnormal microbiome composition. They have dysbiosis. And some of these children, everyone's an individual, of course, but some of these children have increased rate of clostridial species. Now, if I can just give you just a little study about glyphosate and clostridia, there was a great study published by Monica Kruger in Veterinary Medicine some years ago from Germany, and she did a study with glyphosate and chicken's poop. And she found that glyphosate selectively killed off the beneficial bacteria, such as lactobacilli and bifidobacteria, and selectively increase the growth of pathogenic bacteria, such as salmonella and clostridial species. Clostridia, some people may have heard of Clostridia difficile or C. diff. So those clostridial species are found to be very high in autistic children. Now, if you were to ask me, is it because of the glyphosate, I couldn't answer you. I can tell you what it's found in chickens. I can tell you what I see in autistic kids. I can tell you what I do to get them better, but I don't have any human data. So you can see the dilemma facing a clinician. But I think that will give you a flavor of some of the things affecting our children's health, such as kids on the spectrum.
Thank you. Vincan, since you deal with health policies, we're finding some foreign nations now coming down hard on the agricultural chemical industry. Russian Putin has basically banned GMOs of any kind from Russia. And the Russian government foresees its nation being the organic food capital on the planet. And the new coalition government in Germany yesterday said they plan to phase out glyphosate use as quickly as possible. Add to that the Netherlands, Sri Lanka, and also Argentina have now banned it. This is more of a health policy issue and not simply an agricultural decision by legislators. And there seems to be a bipolar disconnect in Washington between the agricultural industry and public health. Can you go into this in depth and explain the obstacles in all our federal agencies to better serve public health and prevention of disease instead of being public sponsors of corporate interest and the corporate profits?
Well, that's a big problem. I mean, I don't know that I can explain why, our country is more aligned these days with benefiting corporations than humans and certainly human health, but it's certainly a problem that we're facing. But yes, we have this history of very big support on the part of government for, farmers, rural American farmers. And, 100 years or so ago, not quite, we shifted over to, mass cash crop agriculture and began subsidizing post-Depression era, began subsidizing the farmers in this country to produce mass cash crops for which we had to produce foods such as cereals and processed foods. And so there's been a paradigm of growing our foods in this way for many, many years. And Andrew Kimball, who works at the Center for Food Safety, talks about this as a zombie paradigm in which we grow our food using massive numbers of chemicals that deplete the soil. We genetically modify the food products and the seeds so that they have to be bought new each season and are themselves genetically modified in ways that we now know are probably unsafe for health. And, this loops farmers into this huge problem of being dependent on the agrochemical companies in ways that may have been profitable initially but are no longer profitable. And even the National Academies of Science and Technology and Medicine has reported that the evidence of the fiscal benefits are really not there anymore. And yet we're stuck in this paradigm. It's all politics. In terms of health policy, I would say that, the best thing that we can do is to encourage support for local agriculture, support for organic agriculture, support for labeling GM food so that people have a choice. There's some indication that even some of the big food processing companies are aware of the fact that organic is the future. And that's all very hopeful. But we do talk about this in the book, about how there are several constituencies that probably still need to be won over in order to see real change here. One is support for the many, many parents who are trying to keep their kids healthy and to get food, good food choices for their children. And this is sometimes even against the naysaying and doubt and skepticism of other parents and grandparents even, who think it's no big deal to just let the kids have that processed food while they're with them. And then the second constituency is the scientific community. The scientists really, I think, are skeptical about the idea that GM foods could be harmful. And I think that's probably because they have for many years now relied on genetic modification technologies for a lot of the research that they do. And we are very clear in the book that we are not against the use of genetic modification technologies for research in biomedicine. There are a lot of good uses that this technology can be put to and already is being used for example, in the production of insulin. But keep in mind, all of those products are tested on humans before they go to market. And of course, in the use of animal test subjects, we don't eat them, so we don't have to worry about testing them before they get consumed. And then the third constituency that we really focus on in the book are the medical doctors. And for this, we really emphasize the need for rethinking the paradigm on the relationships between soil health, food health, and gut health. And we call this eco-medicine. And, we're hopeful that some doctors might read this and be influenced by it, or at least open-minded about taking a second look at the science here.
And, okay, I'd like to address, I'd like for both of you to hear what I have to say on this. I'm going to use two examples. One is a major pharmaceutical company that came out of pretty much nowhere, but it became very popular on Wall Street because it was not acting like a pharmaceutical company where about 18 to 20% of their money goes into research. It was only 3%. It was purely buying companies and then inflating the prices of every one of those companies' best-selling drugs. Hence the idea that you could go to India and get a hepatitis C medication for about $2 a day. That same medication was $700 a pill in the United States. And this was across all the products. And suddenly you were seeing people spending their life savings to be treated for any disease. There was no complaints in the medical community, no complaints from Wall Street. They were happy about it. In fact, some of the biggest names on Wall Street, some of the big hedge fund owners got involved in the company. And its value went up to almost $72 billion. But it didn't make anything. It bought companies that did and then hiked the prices up. The media didn't complain. Medicine, science, legislation, nobody complained except when it was politically convenient. Oh, we're paying so much for a particular drug. What was the question that was not addressed? Do we need these drugs in the first place? Is there any other way to prevent these conditions so a person doesn't have to take a drug? He could take a lifestyle. And if we do have an opportunity to treat someone with a drug that's been proven safe or effective, why can't they get the generic one? Because profit dominates medicine. Another example would be the case of a Volkswagen. Volkswagen was nearly bankrupt. They only sold about 36,000 cars in the United States in 1 year. They brought in a new CEO, and they came up with a gimmick, clean diesel. Well, we all know diesel is extremely toxic, but they sold over 11 million cars worldwide in a short period of time, with people saying, hey, I want a Volkswagen, I want a nice car with a great reputation. The largest factory in the world is Volkswagen's factory in one town and 60,000 employees. And so they prospered until we found out that hundreds of people involved from the engineers right up to the very top of Volkswagen had conspired to trick the public because it was not pollution-free. It was very polluting. An independent test showed it. The government wasn't concerned. The media wasn't concerned. Wall Street was only concerned that it would cost Volkswagen. Volkswagen paid a fine. The CEO and none of the top German officials went to jail, nor their reputations besmirched. And people went right back to buying Volkswagen, and now they're right back up there again. And people went right back to banking with HSBC, even though it laundered almost $1 billion in drug money after they paid a fine. So we have this phenomena, this cognitive disconnect. And finally, in an interview with Dr. Dean Ornish, who proved for the first time medically by publishing the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, and the New England Journal of Medicine, two separate studies showing that he could reverse heart disease with diet, lifestyle, exercise, stress management. I was there when he was doing it, filming him doing it. And I remember at the time I said, Dr. Ornish, what is your most important hope? And he said that this will influence doctors to see that you don't have to have coronary bypasses and angioplasties and stents. At the same level, we can save a lot of people, not just stop a problem, but reverse it. And now we have the proof we can do it. Nobody cared. I spoke with board-certified cardiologist, oh, yeah, Dean Ornish, good work there. Do you follow his diet? Well, no. So from my perspective, trying to be as objective as possible, don't bet that either the public or the medical community is going to change the way they think, their perceptions or their practices, because you've shown that what a person eats and how they live can impact their overall health. Because in nowhere in our society do paradigms change. That's why I use the other examples. So I just wanted to share that because I hear every time someone comes on about how, you know, we're hoping, look, you got 900,000 doctors. I could fit all the holistic doctors out of those 900,000 in my apartment. So it's not that they're stupid, uninformed, that they can't understand what you're doing. They absolutely have the same type of quality and background, intellect, and discipline as anyone else. It's just they look at it differently. You have a more altruistic and a moral compass that you're using. They don't. So I do not apologize for the rest of medicine. Your thoughts, please.
Certainly, Gary. This is Michelle here. That was quite a bit, and thank you for sharing that. I can tell you that I am a bit more hopeful that there is an impetus for change, and I'm going to tell you why. There is a parallel universe occurring outside of the traditional medical system, we'll call it Western medicine for the sake of argument, where it's being driven by women, and they're the women of sick children. And so what's happening now is there is a mom's universe that's being created, running parallel to the Western medical system, seeking solutions and answers to their children's diabetes or asthma or whatever we were talking about, autism, that's occurring as we speak. And these women are educating themselves in terms of integrative health and nutrition and holistic medicine, and they are becoming counselors and educators and making movies and writing blogs. And the force is powerful. Not only is these women are creating, and that's who a part of who Vincent and I were speaking to. We have a chapter called Warrior Moms, because so many of the people who are taking care of these sick children happen to be women. This is no disrespect to the dads out there, but it happens to often fall on women's shoulders. So we have this movement, this parallel paradigm shift happening in the medical movement. What's also happening, again, because of the pervasiveness of these diseases, is that healthcare providers' own children are becoming sick. And that also is promoting change, because when it hits your family, all of a sudden there's a different dialogue that's happening. Now, I am not defending at all my Western-trained colleagues in this, because I take issue with so many of the things that you already mentioned as well. But I can tell you that in medical school, you are trained to think in a pharmacological model, not a holistic model, not a systems biology model, not a holistic model. It's pill for ill medicine, and that's how doctors are trained yet, even today, although nutritional medicine is now 2 weeks of med school versus the 2 hours that I have. Northwestern Medical School offers 2 weeks of a functional medicine elective that medical students can take. There are more holistic programs happening across the country. So there are shifts, quick enough, not in my book either. But also take into account that I have asked pediatricians about these very questions. I've spoken to my colleagues, like, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? Most of them feel overwhelmed to address these issues because they have 10 to 15 minutes a slot. And to get into the kind of complex chronic disease that with the patients we talk about in the book, one of my visits took an hour and a half. There is no way on those five patients in their hour that they can even begin to scratch the surface of these issues. So right there, how our medical model is set up cannot possibly address the chronicity of and the complex issues that are facing not just our children, it's adult medicine as well. And coupled with that, and I'll just throw it out there, is now since 2016, the electronic health record is a mandatory tool in every physician's office. Statistics now show that the electronic health records, called the EHR, has added 20% more time on to the average physician's day. So doctors now have to spend more time massaging a computer than taking care of their patients. So I'm not trying to defend our community, but perhaps offer explanation some of the challenges that they're facing.
I could jump in on that as well, if that's okay.
Yes.
I will say, you know, being in a medical school and teaching medical students and seeing what they're learning and, you know, there is an amazing amount of extraordinary work going on in our medical institutions. I'm at one of the top institutions in the country, and it's pretty much a miracle a day. I mean, if you are dying of cancer, they can probably cure you now. You can transplant your heart. There are miracles happening in modern medicine, and we shouldn't discount that. It is an extraordinary thing. At the same time, you will not find a more, you know, hardened cynic about medicine than me, probably. And we do talk about this in the book. There's a whole chapter on the history of efforts among medical students, believe it or not, at various institutions across the country to get rid of the influence of Big Pharma. Now, Big Pharma is a wonderful thing and a terrible thing. You know, there are people out there, there are doctors out there who have recognized the problem. And how did we end up with pill for ill medicine? Okay, one of the reasons is that the pharmaceutical interests are very pervasive in medical education. They don't, and they have long historically tried to prevent the teaching of courses on nutrition in medical system, medical education. That's a problem. We need to get that kind of influence out. We need to clean it up. And for that, we need stronger government controls and regulatory processes, more like what you have in the National Health Services in England or in France and other countries. The second reason, though, is one that really comes back to roost with the individual patient. Doctors have found that patients don't like to change their behavior. Surprise, surprise. Doctors try to tell people not to eat bad food, and they still eat bad food. So, you know, one of the reasons that pills are used and overused, I would say, in medicine is that they're like magic bullets. They take care of the problems that people aren't willing to take care of on their own. So there's a conspiracy of problems at work here, and it's not just one thing, and it's not just, you know, that pharma is completely terrible or that doctors are completely terrible. It's that there are these series of things that have brought us to this predicament today. Now, being hopeful, as I see it, is you know, only one part of the story. You also have to be vigilant about your politics and getting, you know, corruption out of the system and getting undue influence out of the system and that sort of thing. But you also have to be proactive and really support the directions that some institutions are going in. For instance, Michelle talked about the effort on the part of many medical schools across the country to respond to student desires for more integrative approaches to health. We're a long way from getting there, but even if they just paid more attention to food, for goodness sakes, just more attention to food would get us a long way, I think.
Okay. I appreciate those inputs, but we have about 10 minutes to go, and I wanted to get some specifics in. Michelle, back to you. We are now discovering how powerful epigenetic influences are between a mother's consumption of GMOs and toxic foods with the development of the infant and the illnesses witnessed after birth. Also, for a long time, opponents of the use of glyphosate have focused on its health risk. But now Monsanto's dicamba, which is being used against weeds that Roundup is failing to get rid of, is taking a spotlight. We do not hear about this herbicide much. What are the health risks being observed now in the consumption or exposure to dicamba, D-I-C-A-M-B-A, and others you can speak about?
Yeah, so there are different classes of pesticides and herbicides, rather, and they all have different health effects. The 2,4-D, the dicamba, which is now being, which was initially banned and then reallowed back on the market, I believe, in January of this year, is a contentious point, and many states are actually suing the government as we speak to get rid of dicamba. There are big issues happening in states like Arkansas and other areas. The problem with dicamba is that it doesn't stay put. It aerosolizes. And so, therefore, it spreads to crops that are not herbicide tolerant, to non-dicamba tolerant crops. And it's killing crops across various states. I think I read last count, and I might have to stand correct on this, Gary, that the last count there were 34 states reporting problems with dicamba. So that is one particular issue, as you bring up. Now, they have created an herbicide-tolerant dicamba, and so they have to change the genetic modification structure and stack the genes in a certain way so that those crops don't die when it's sprayed. So dicamba is becoming a problem. To your question about epigenetics, absolutely. We know that to change the genetic structure is not possible. There is not a change in the genetic order. What is influenced, particularly by food, by intoxicants, by pesticides, by herbicides, are the epigenes, these little groups that sit on top of the gene, your gene. They're little methyl groups, they're acyl groups, and these can be influenced by these toxicants and also be influenced by the microbiome. They can be influenced by stress. And though, for example, if you look at certain chemicals, can influence the epigenome, these little methyl groups, and turn off and on these genes, which then affects expression or lack thereof of expression of certain things. So this whole field of epigenetics is emerging in the field of nutrition. It's called nutrigenomics. of this relationship because there are foods that can affect your epigenome, that different foods, yes, food is medicine, food is data, food is information, can also have an interplay with the epigene. Now, what happens to mom happens to baby. Those epigenes are passed on to that fetus and that newborn, and those traits can then be manifest. And actually, the body thinks that it's helping the newborn because whatever happened to mom is trying to tell the baby, hey, you may need to look at this, and this could be these epigene switches might be a methodology for survival for the newborn. And that's one of the ideas of why these epigenetic changes actually happen. So this is important information, Gary. It's huge in terms of medicine. The future is in the epigenetics, in what we're being exposed to, and the impact, the interrelation, web relationship with our microbiome. Did I answer your question?
Yes, it did, and I appreciate it. Venkan, mm-hmm. I'd like for you to address, you made reference to echo medicine. Based upon my years of research and study into nutrition and also the principles of organic and biodynamic farming and soil health and the psycho-spiritual relationships we have with the environment and ecology that promotes a healthy mind and body, I'd like you to give us a broad vision of what the theory of echo medicine is. Most listeners will not have heard of this term, and so it'll be new for them.
Sure, I'd love to. So it's basically this idea that there's a connection between the health of the soil in which food is grown and the health of the gut microbiome. So ultimately, if you're not growing food in healthy soil with healthy microbes and healthy nutrients, your food is not going to have those things. Or if your food has been grown in a way that kills those things, you're not going to have healthy food. Once you put that in your gut also can't be fed with the nutrition that it needs. So we know that organic food is more nutritious. We know that it keeps the soils more nutritious, and it uses less pesticides. So that idea that there's a connection between the gut health and the soil health is what we're really asking, what we're really focusing on here. And there are other ways that people talk about it. One is a great book by Daphne Miller called Pharmacology, F-A-R-M ecology, so replacing pharmaceuticals with healthy farming techniques. There are some eco-medicine references among colleagues of mine at UCSF who talk about the need to reform the clinical encounter in ways that are more thoughtful about the whole ecosystem of health, that is the whole environment that a person is living in, plays a role in their health. So not just looking at food, but looking at exposure to toxicants and other things in the environment, toxic chemicals, PCBs, phthalates, those kinds of things, all of which play a role in producing ill health, of course, but of all of which have been very marginal to medical diagnoses. And so that's what we're basically getting at in that view of eco-medicine, this idea that we're only as healthy as the food that we're eating, which is only as healthy as the soil it is grown in. And for that, we need to rethink the whole paradigm of agriculture.
I appreciate it. Michelle, the last question to you, and if you could make it a little short, please. For many people, do they, who want to make change, is it simply to switch to an organic dietary regimen to clear up the adverse effects of GMO foods that have been manifesting in their cells and microbiome? Or should other detoxification measures be taken? And is there any advice you can provide for how we can reverse adverse effects of the standard American diet?
Certainly. I'll make it brief. As you know, integrated medicine is individualistic, so often, you know, we try to prescribe per patient. However, the sicker the patient, the more complex history, medical history, the more that needs to be done. If there is a patient who is of good health, all they really need to do is switch to organic food and get a water filter. If you take that up a notch for somebody who might be experiencing chronic headaches, bloating, IBS, digestive issues, perhaps that person, the organic water filter, and they need to take, let's say, gluten and dairy out of their diet, which are both pretty inflammatory foods, and they can experiment with different types of diets. If you have a patient who's suffering from metabolic syndrome, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, autoimmune disease, I would lead them toward a paleo diet with a low-carb diet, again, all organic. You see, now, if for those people who are suffering the mal-effects of glyphosate, of pesticides, and GMOs, there are healing modalities that I go into with my patients specifically, and Gary, that may be the next book. However, what people can do, if they can just focus on some herbs in their diet and drink it in a smoothie, those can have tremendous healing effects, such as dandelion. I say eat them, don't spray them, cilantro, parsley, and then putting those herbs in their smoothie with lemon, including some of the peel, fresh ginger, and, you know, some other veggies and fruit. And there are other detoxifying herbs and, like, beets that are really helpful for the liver, where through food we can restore and support our body's innate ability to heal itself. So those would be some very general guidelines. And with my patients, I go into a lot of treatment protocols. You see it in our patients in the book, and specifics will be coming forth in the next book.
Good. Thank you. I want to thank both of you, Professor Venkan Adams, Professor and Vice Chair of Medical Anthropology in the Department of Anthropology and History and Social Medicine, University of California Medical School, and also Dr. Michelle Perot. And both are the co-authors of What's Making Our Children Sick? How Industrial Food is Causing an Epidemic of Chronic Illness and What Parents and Doctors Can Do About It. And the website is Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N, medical.com. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you for having us. Pleasure, Gary. Thank you.
I'm Gary Enall. That's the end of our program. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Stop right on.